Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
See?
Yep.
Are we ready?
I think though? We are. Maybe
you have to get in closer.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, we should do the thing. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
Can you just tell us who you are?
Well, I don't believe I'm going to reveal that.
Well, it'll be revealed in time. This is a Radiolab about wars and games.
War games.
War games, exactly.
Great movie.
Yeah, remember there was a moment in that movie where a certain game
broke the
computer?
Yeah.
Yes, let's take a look. Just, you know, let's begin with that game. You don't have to know, you listeners, what game we're talking about. That will become clear. Unless you happen to be in, Irkutsk, but thereby lies a tale.
Yeah. And first, we're going to start with this international man of mystery.
Yes.
Who are you really?
No, I'm Ian Fraser.
Ian is a writer for the New Yorker magazine, and we had Ian come to visit us because we were working together on a show about games.
And in that show, we ended up talking about
baseball, football, basketball, checkers, chess. But Ian says there was a game that we totally ignored.
Tic-tac-toe, 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 tic-tac-toe,
tic-tac-toe, tic-tac-toe. Yeah, tic-tac-toe.
All right, so what's the deal with you and tic-tac-toe? I mean, you learned it at age 5, I'm assuming, like everybody?
Exactly like everybody else. Yeah, of course.
Okay.
But I mean, as you get older, it's one of the first sort of levels of sophistication that you reach is that you know how to get a draw in every tic-tac-toe game, and you learn that at about age maybe 6, I would say. And after that, it's just formality.
It's
just
sort of a developmental milestone, gaming-wise.
It is. But when you realize...
You're allowed to be sophisticatedly bored with the game.
Right. And you go, oh, yes, I'm very good at that.
So you reached the mature age of 6 and achieved a certain amount of tic-tac-toe sophistication.
I would say I was a grandmaster.
Yeah.
But the problem is, when you get to that grandmaster point, everybody else is a grandmaster, too. And so... Everything is a draw, and the game basically dies.
Right.
And so, like the rest of us, Ian stopped playing tic-tac-toe. But then, when he was well into his middle life, he ran into something that made him think, well, maybe tic-tac-toe can still do something for me.
Right, right.
What happened?
Well, I went to Russia, and I traveled all over, and I was in Chukotka, which is the part of the Russian Far East, opposite Alaska. It's not a great distance, but it's an enormous distance in terms of culture. And at that time, my Russian language was very weak. And I was staying with this, a young couple who had a 6-year-old son named Igor. And because of the level of my language, I got along very well with preschool children and elementary school teachers. And he actually... could speak some English. He had like about 8 or 10 words. And the first thing Igor said to me was, "How do you do?" And he was just incredibly cute and a nice kid. And so we were just hanging out and I was able to talk to him.
And then on a whim, really, he said...
I said, well, let's play tic-tac-toe. And
how did you get that idea?
Yeah.
Because it was just something to do with a kid. I don't even remember how we got that idea. But we were just sitting around, and I explained the game to him. And he had never heard of it.
Really?
He had no idea what it was.
Wow.
And I just showed him by drawing how you do this, X's and O's. And he picked it up. I mean, he understood what it was. And then we started playing. And he very quickly got the principle. But I, to be honest, was clobbering him.
But there was there a certain kind of joy?
Just like, uh-uh. That's not where the O goes. And then there's three X's, pal. You're out of here. And he would be quite crushed. You're like, oh, no, I lost again. But wait. It's really fun to play tic-tac-toe with someone who doesn't know how, because you're just walking all over them and just putting X's and O's.
Is this fair? I mean, is this something a mature...
Technically, it was not fair. So I stayed with them before we made this trip into the tundra. And we went out into the tundra. We were there for a week or 10 days or something. And then I came back and stayed with them again. I do not believe he had been playing tic-tac-toe in my absence, but somehow he had gotten better. And so we had very, very ordinary and frustrating games from my point of view. As we came back, I didn't win as readily at all. I later checked, and listeners may contradict me, but as far as I know, this game is unknown in Russia. And I've asked Russian friends.
Unknown completely. 6 years old and up?
And up.
How wide is the shadow of non-tic-tac-toe-dom? We established that it's in Eastern Russia. Maybe you could go to Japan and they wouldn't know how to play it. I mean, I don't know.
Well, it would be interesting just to find out where tic-tac-toe is elsewhere.
And where it isn't.
Yeah.
Not that I'm going to do it myself.
No.
This could be one of these crowdsourcing opportunities.
Why is that?
Well, we could ask people to help map it for us. Because, like, what if there are whole corners of the globe that are virginal territory?
So you could go to playgrounds and you could, like, walk in and
say, hey, kid.
Smush them.
Come here.
So we decided to test this proposition.
After we talked to Ian, we put a call on our Facebook page asking for people to help us make a map. And we got responses.
Hello, I am coming to you from Gwangju, South Korea.
Actually, lots.
In the north of Iran, near the Caspian Sea.
Zagreb, Croatia.
Poznan, Poland.
Istanbul, Turkey.
Christchurch, New Zealand.
The Philippines.
I'm here in Seattle, Washington.
Costa Rica.
The Netherlands.
Argentina.
Caribbean, Namibia.
Japan. Dublin, Ireland.
The outskirts of Aarhus, Denmark.
It's a typically hot day here in Dubai.
Instructions were pretty simple. Grab a cell phone, whatever you got that can record. Go out.
Now, let's get on with our business.
And take a survey.
So I think we found our first victim.
Here we have two nice people walking by.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Japan's phone movie
fan. Hello, sir. Have you heard of...
Excuse me, ¿puedo hacer una pregunta?
¿Qué es tic-tac-toe?
A game called tic-tac-toe.
Tic-tac-toe.
Kuya, alam niyo po ba yung dalawang tic-tac-toe?
Who here has ever heard of the game
tic-tac-toe?
Tic-tac-toe.
So, here are the results, which may surprise you. We'll go country by country. Everybody interviewed a lot of people, so what you will hear is representative. We'll start with Japan.
Do you know tic-tac-toe? Tic-tac-toe. Know this game?
No.
No?
No.
Japan, no.
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 Argentina, no.
She doesn't know.
No.
But
Ireland, no.
Do you know what it is, sir?
No.
No one knows how to play tic-tac-toe.
Namibia.
Yes, sir.
Nope.
No.
Switzerland, no.
Tic-tac-toe?
Turkey.
No.
Croatia?
No.
New Zealand?
Tic-tac-toe. Is it a dance?
No, it's a game. So you've never played tic-tac-toe?
No, I haven't, no.
No.
Iran?
The answer is... No.
So, amazingly, it seemed like huge chunks of the globe do not know tic-tac-toe.
Booyah.
So a tic-tac-toe hustler could clean up.
Cha-ching.
Or forget hustling. Maybe you just want to believe there are still some blank spots left on the globe. Well, here you are.
Yes!
But, just to be safe, we asked everybody to go out, not just with their cell phones, but with a pen and a paper, so that when someone says no, they could draw them the grid, just to be certain.
Let me show you. Okay.
We have X's and we have O's. And
X.
Like this, this, or this. Uh-huh.
So if I am X, and then it's your turn.
You try to stop me.
And you have to get three in a row.
And this is when the answers changed.
So I'll say O. So X. Then X.
Marubatsu game.
Yeah.
Oh, you know that. Okay.
You didn't win. Once people saw the grid with the X's and O's, they were like, oh, yeah, we know that game. Of course. We just don't call it tic-tac-toe.
The game has a different name in Turkish?
Yes.
In Turkish, it's called
X-O-X.
X-O-X. In Serbia?
X-Ox.
X-Ox.
¿Cómo se llama en Perú? What's the name in Peru?
Michi.
Peru, it's Michi. And in South Korea?
What do you call it?
Omo.
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 And in England...
Which, what is it called?
Knots and crosses.
Knots and crosses.
Knots and crosses.
Crosses. Yeah, yeah.
Which is also what they call it in Ireland and...
We call it knots and crosses.
New Zealand. Now, in Switzerland...
Morpion, it's known in the French language.
That is what they call it in Polish.
Kuko i krzyżek.
It's kuko i krzyżek.
Does everybody in Poland know how to play this? Yeah.
And to round things out, in Argentina they call it...
Tateti.
In the Netherlands...
Boterkaas en eieren.
Iran.
No, hune.
Croatia.
Krozic.
And in Costa Rica...
Gato.
Gato.
Let's take a little break and look at our notes, see where we stand so far.
Jenna, I'm beginning to get this feeling...
Seven people interviewed, seven knew it.
That our dreams of glory...
They all know what tic-tac-toe is.
That we were going to, you know, we were going to be the Genghis Khans of tic-tac-toe.
It just may not be supported by the data. But we got Russia, right?
Well,
Hi, Ian Fraser. Hi, this is Soren. I work with Robert.
I don't know if we have Russia, actually. Because as we were conducting our international tic-tac-toe survey, I got a note from Ian. It looked like an uh-oh note, so I called him up, and he told me that shortly after we talked to him that first time...
It was maybe even the same day.
He was at a party, and there were some Russians.
And I just thought, okay, let me just make sure about this. And I asked, and they said, yes, of course, there's tic-tac-toe. And I said, wow, everybody told me this. And they said, yeah, sure, everybody knows it. A friend even told me the name of it. It's Kreski-Nolski, which is like crosses and zeros. And he said, yeah, it's well known. And the entire thing fell to the ground at that point. So, sorry. I'm sorry. I base this on insufficient data. And it's completely wrong. It's not completely wrong, because I did encounter, you know, some people who didn't know. And this one kid who I can promise you, I just beat the pants off of in tic-tac-toe. He had no idea. But that was the limit of my conquest. Tic-tac-toe.
Ian Fraser is the author of Travels in Siberia and a whole bunch of wonderful books. For more information, go to our website, radiolab.org.
Oh, and before we go, thank you to our international tic-tac-toe surveyors.
Alberto Arias.
Tumaj Rashtitalab.
Chris Rounds.
Seroj Amini.
Chris Vena.
Salvador Vasquez.
Krista Hand.
Tarek Yassin.
My name is Mara.
Chelsea Unruh.
Paddy Cahill.
This is Myra.
This is Marianne.
And this is Slotbar.
This is Spanky.
Nick Glastonbury.
My name is Jimena.
Dad Bazemon.
My name is Otoluksha.
Mr. Gimo.
And my name is Pedro Amrafai.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
Next up.
Talk about it, Jed. Talk about these next characters that are coming.
Oh, well, you've got Wolverine, you've got Raven, who can shapeshift, Storm, who can control the weather.
You can change your shape at will, you can bounce off buildings, you can fly, you can stink, you can turn everybody into frozen water.
And then someone calls you a freaking doll.
They call you a doll.
Come on.
Will that stand?
No.
Stick around,
maybe.
Because there's
sure.
A battle coming on. Doll or superhero? You decide.
Hi, this is Nele from Hamburg, Germany. Radiolab is supported, in part, by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Okay, welcome back. This is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
And up next...
This is a story about what goes where and what doesn't go there and what should...
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program that is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you, either way, for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
I'd go there if you were only smarter about it. Ike, Swiss Kind of Russia, are you around?
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about.
Set it up for us, Ike.
Well, let's start back in 1993.
Okay.
Yes.
With two customs attorneys.
I'm Sherry Singer.
And my name is Indy Singh.
Singer and Singh.
Singer and Singh.
And one day, the two of them are looking at this customs book called the Harmonized Tariff Schedule.
What was it called again? The Harmon what?
Harmonized Tariff.
Harmonized tariff. You almost harmonized the Harmonized Tariff.
It's this huge book, chock full of customs classifications.
Meat products, milk products, vegetables.
And it's got everything in it.
Literally thousands of provisions.
So they're flipping through this big book. And what they noticed that day is that in this book were the following words.
Representing only human beings.
They saw this fateful phrase right next to the word doll.
Under the harmonized, a doll was something that represented only a human being.
A doll represented a human
only
being.
Only a human
being. Only a human being.
Yeah, it could not be any other creature but a human being.
So Barbie is a doll.
Right,
so
but here's the thing. In this big book, right next to dolls, is this whole other category called toys.
Toys.
Which covers
things like monsters, robots, angels.
Basically anything that isn't only representing a human.
So the dolls are human and the toys are not human.
Yeah, and where it gets weird is that these two categories were being taxed differently.
How? How differently?
12% for dolls and 6.8% for toys.
Really? So getting a Barbie doll into the country would be more expensive than like importing a Transformer or something?
Yeah.
Why?
I assume it was because there was a domestic industry.
A domestic doll industry.
That wanted and needed protection.
Do you think there was a powerful doll lobby? Anyhow, you got these two categories. You got these two ladies, and they have a client called Marvel Comics.
Marvel Comics. This is the home of men with capes.
Yes.
And superpowers.
Yes.
And beautiful boots.
Tights.
Marvel, yes.
What about Marvel?
Well, Marvel Comics has this universe of action figures coming into our ports as dolls.
Wait, all their action figures were being classified as dolls?
Everything was a doll.
Yeah.
At 12% rate of duty.
And Sherry and Indy realize that there's a huge opportunity here. If they can convince the government to remove the Marvel action heroes from the human-y Barbie doll category and push them into the robot demon-y toy category, they can save a huge amount of money.
We saw dollars.
Tens of thousands of maybe hundreds of dollars.
Well, how much?
Thousands of dollars.
She's 50, up, up.
A million she's, dollars. She's,
and then some.
More than $1 million?
Because they wouldn't be taxed as high.
But this is about more than just business. This is about more than Saturday morning cartoons. This is about what it means to be a human.
What? What do you mean?
Well, think about it. They have to convince government officials that under U.S. law, these characters are not considered human.
Dastardly, really.
So Sherry and Indy headed to Customs.
Customs headquarters.
In D.C., with a giant bag full of superheroes.
We actually went down there. We had a meeting. We brought samples of all the items. And
you brought action figures, you mean?
We did. We had 60 or 80 figures.
And one by one.
We tried to convince them that these figures
do not represent a human being.
And believe it or not, this meeting ended up in a series of court cases that went on for 10 years.
10 years?
Because where it got really complicated and interesting is when they got to Marvel's crown jewel, the X-Men.
We really didn't even read the stories. Sherry and I were not familiar with comic books. Sherry,
well, they should have, because it's a great story. I mean, the story of X-Men is kind of about the next phase of human evolution. Regular parents having regular kids, but some of these kids, around their awkward teen years, start to develop these strange mutant powers.
So the story is humans who mutate.
Yeah, well, that's what makes this so legally tricky. I mean, are these characters still human, or have they evolved somehow out of humanness into something entirely different?
Now, the government says that all of the imported action figures, they are representations of human beings if they have things like a head,
right,
a mouth, eyes, nose, hair, arms, torso, breasts, muscles. If you look at any of these guys, Cyclops, he has all the basic elements that are the government's definition of a human being. And what do you say?
Well,
eventually, to make their point, Sherry and Indy pulled out a blue furry guy that X-Men fans might know as Beast.
We can look at Beast.
This is Beast.
One that we won early on.
Well, he's called Beast.
Even Customs.
But he has a head. He has two arms. He has two legs.
Yeah,
he does have those.
He wears glasses.
In response
often
to Robert's comment.
But you know, yeah, Beast in the X-Men storyline, he's a pretty sophisticated guy. He's a thoughtful intellectual. Am I right, Ike?
Yeah, you would be the first X-Men to quote
Shakespeare.
He wears
glasses.
He quotes Shakespeare.
He ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And men in England now are bed, will count their manhoods cheap. So don't you think that puts him well down the human sort of bell curve?
Well, in this case, our argument would be is human beings do not have blue skin.
The judge agreed.
And it doesn't resemble a human horns being.
That's a pretty safe argument.
There are human beings with bluish skin, you should know.
Beast is harder to fit into the mold of what we customarily know as human.
That's Joe Liebman. He worked on the case for the government side.
He has aspects that perhaps are closer to the monster.
But it gets trickier. Take the most popular X-Man.
Wolverine.
He's got muscular arms and legs.
He puts on a coat and a flannel shirt, and he's a logger.
Sure.
But the eyes, they just didn't look human. Mm. And that's what our basic...
And the claws also.
And the claws.
Metal claws.
Razor-like adamantium claws.
And in the story, a mad scientist implanted them in his arms under his skin.
Right.
But that just means he's a guy who had a little augmentation.
No.
Well, he's developed something we don't know to actually exist. That does not mean
that it might not exist in future humans.
In a world that we have not yet seen.
Joe's basic point is, don't rule it out. He pointed to this runner, Oscar Pistorius.
They call him the Blade Runner, the world's fastest man on no legs.
The double amputee runner from South Africa who wears prosthetic legs that some people claim actually increase his speed.
Saying his prosthetics had more spring than human legs.
And some people say he should be disqualified from competing against able-bodied humans.
The body that governs track and field banned him from competition.
Well, forget about augmentation. What if we're just talking mutation? I mean, as a human, we have about 20,000 genes.
And if one of them just gives you claws, that doesn't mean that the other 19,999 genes are keeping you pretty much in the human classification.
I studied my undergraduate degree is in microbiology and biochemistry.
Oh.
So I know that we have mutations going on in our body constantly.
So we're all mutants.
But in common language and in science fiction, when you use the word mutant...
She says you mean something or someone that's...
disfigured.
Alien. That's no longer like us. So, colloquially, if Marvel calls the X-Men mutants, then...
they're not human.
On the Wolverine case, did you win or lose?
We won.
We won?
Well, how do you feel about this, Ike?
I don't know. I'm kind of seeing red. No, but seriously, here's the thing. In the X-Men universe, all the X-Men are trying to do is fit into our world.
I don't want to hurt you, Eric. I never did.
To feel like a human being.
It's the truth.
Marvel Comics has created this world where mutants want to be treated like humans, and the government is persecuting them as monsters. But in the real world, it's exactly the opposite. You got Marvel saying they're monsters, and you got the government saying, no, let them be human.
In the X-Men universe, humans are very often out to get the mutants. Or dismissive of the mutants, fearful of the mutants, liquidating them, experimenting on them.
First of all, tell us who you are.
I am Brian Singer. I'm a filmmaker.
Brian directed a bunch of the X-Men movies.
X-Men 1, X-Men 2, X-Men United.
And he says all the movies, at their heart, are parables about living in a world where you don't fit, where you're not the right category. In fact, the first X-Men film he directed, the U.S. government fears mutants so much that this U.S. senator puts forward legislation called the Mutant Registration Act.
Mutants are very real, and they are among us. We must know who they are, and above all, we must know what they can do.
That us-them conflict is key to the entire saga.
Well, yeah, and it's no coincidence that it was born during the height of the Civil Rights Movement.
Oh, so this is like, so this is modeled then on a civil, on a moment in world history where people were trying to figure out how to either get along or not get along.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this tension plays out within the mutants themselves, where you have two groups, the X-Men, who
choose to take the stance to defend a world that hates and fears them.
Don't give up on them, Eric.
And then you got this other group of mutants, led by Magneto.
What would you have me do, Charles?
And he doesn't have faith that humanity's ever going to embrace mutants.
We are the future, Charles, not them. They no longer matter.
He saw that what happens when you're different is you get rounded up.
Experimented on, eliminated.
And you're gassed.
It's interesting to hear you describe that, because when I walked out of the most recent movie, I felt such a strong, maybe a stronger connection with Magneto after you saw what he went through.
Yeah, you see the intimate victimization of him, and you root for him because he's ultimately facing a monster.
And when he was making these movies, he had that monster of intolerance and prejudice on his mind, and it was actually pretty personal to him.
Well, there's a photo album my family has, and it starts in the 20s, and I was looking through it, and I recognized the lineage. And then there were a few pages of just these portraits of different people. I didn't know who they were, and I said to my dad, I'm like, who are these people? And my dad goes, they're all gone. They're the ones that are gone from Poland. They're just all gone. They're erased. There's no records. There's no property. There's no nothing.
So he doesn't even know their name?
No. We just know that they're people that were part of the neighborhood and the family in the 30s that never left Poland like my grandparents did and disappeared.
Well, I know this sounds pretty heavy for a comic book, but over the years, the X-Men have been a stand-in for, well, first the civil rights movement of the 60s, and most recently, the story works as an allegory for gay rights.
In fact, in X-Men 2, we actually had a coming out scene.
In the scene, this kid, Bobby Drake, he's hiding some of the X-Men in his parents' house.
And then his parents come home and find him with these strangers.
Aren't you supposed to be at school?
Bobby, who is this guy?
And he is forced basically to show his parents that he's a mutant.
There's something I need to tell you.
Everyone takes a seat in the living room, and Bobby, using his special mutant powers,
he freezes a little cup of coffee. And the parents react in panic.
Bobby.
And the mother actually says,
have you tried not being a mutant?
Really?
Like it's a choice.
We have to find out what the ultimate legal disposition of this case was.
Yeah. So did they in the end say that these characters were human, or did they perpetuate this retail bigotry, Ike, and say that they were non-humans?
You guys really want to know?
Yeah.
We have to know.
We have to. Come on. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Tell us.
Non-humans.
Ah. Seriously?
Yeah. Really? Eventually, the judge ruled that all Marvel heroes, not just the X-Men, are not human.
So Sherry and Indy won.
We're not civil rights
lawyers. So when you're having your nice meal after the case, and you don't feel at all that you have just robbed humanity from a whole population.
A little strong.
No, we had absolutely no guilt at all, like none.
Wow. Well, thank you, Ike.
You're welcome, Jeff.
That would be Ike Srikandaraja, our reporter on this story. We also had a fine producer,
Matthew Kielty.
Thank you, Matt. And coming up, we go to perhaps the most warlike group that I've ever met. This is a very successful team of warriors who've taken over arguably the largest patch of Earth that any conqueror has ever conquered. And that's coming up right after this.
This is Timothy Franzik calling from Stillwater, Minnesota. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Hey, this is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich. This hour, we're talking about war and games and borders, in this case.
Borders, yeah. Yes. In this next segment.
It's nice out here.
We're on a road trip in Escondido, California.
Which is close to San Diego.
Regular suburban neighborhood.
Sprinklers, lawns.
Nice houses.
Pretty ordinary.
Except...
This might be him. Do you think that's him?
For David Holway.
Good, how are you?
David is an ecologist and an evolutionary biologist from UC San Diego.
So, yeah, you can just park.
And when we saw him, he was standing in the street.
Oh, he's got the things. He's got the things. Holding what looked like some kind of
nice
hookah pipe. When we got out of the car, he walked us over to the side of the road near a driveway and pointed down.
You can see Argentine ants in the along the curb here.
Oh, there's a little guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just going to collect some Argentine ants from the side of this sidewalk.
You are scraping the surface of the dirt with your fingers.
As soon as he scrapes, about 100 ants just appear and start running in every direction.
So what we're seeing are just small numbers of workers that were probably in the leaf litter at the surface.
Doesn't seem so small, though.
No,
it looks like they're everywhere.
This is tiny.
This is tiny? There's a lot of them.
First hundreds. Then thousands
you
of them
are
here.
Wrecking up their day. Look at you. You like keep... Now, the reason the three of us, grown adults, are now squatting on this little patch of dirt in somebody's front lawn is because around 10 years ago, David and colleagues discovered that this very spot, at this particular driveway...
Yeah, we're at 2211 Eucalyptus.
...in front of this house...
...was the edge of a vast empire.
Right about at this driveway.
And that empire ends right at that one driveway, 221 Eucalyptus.
To demonstrate this, David takes this hookah thing that he's carrying.
So there's a tube that you suck on that connects to a vial.
He sticks the tube into the scrum.
Sucks up a few ants.
Drops them into the vial.
Okay, you just put one at one.
It's that one right there.
Okay. So
and then he walked just to the other side of the driveway, like 17 steps, sucked up some ants on that side.
So here's a new guy. plopped them into the same cup. There's that one right there. And waited.
So far, nobody seems to...
So you've got these ants from different sides of the driveway in the same cup, and at first, they don't seem to notice each other.
Okay, so we're watching one guy,
And then...
Right away.
Wow.
The two ants just lunge at each other.
Oh my gosh.
They lock antenna, and soon, they're in a ball.
This isn't good.
That is heavy-duty fighting. They're seriously rolling around.
Yeah. Looks like it's got a hold of a leg, and the other one's got a hold of a leg.
They're wrestling. Look at them.
It's got its antenna ripped off.
And it's also missing a couple legs.
So it got yanked off?
The entire one side. Look at that. See, one side of his legs are missing. He's going around in circles because he has nowhere else to go.
It's no holds barred.
Now, here's the thing. What we saw in that cup between those two ants was a tiny version of what is happening all over the planet.
This one family of ants,
the one on the left of the driveway, not the right,
has fought its way not only across huge hunks of America, they now control enormous swaths of the globe. And how they pulled this off, well, that's maybe more frightening than the fact that they've done it.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to get to all that, but first, we have to go back to the mid-1800s, to a little place in the northeastern corner of Argentina.
That's right.
Have you ever been to this place?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've been there several times.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Actually, on the first...
That's Neil Tsutsui. He's an evolutionary biologist and says, if you're an ant, this place is kind of special.
Meaning hellish.
Because it's a place where two rivers come together.
Yeah, it's this region in the floodplain between the Rio Paraná and the Rio Uruguay.
A lot of different kinds of ants live there in this little spot. And he says, when it rains, which it does there all the time,
the floodwaters rise, and everybody's home gets flooded and you have to flee.
The ants are forced up into the trees or any high ground.
That's ecologist Mark Moffat.
And then as the water falls, all these different subgroups meet again and they have to start battling from scratch.
That's my land.
It's my land.
And I land.
My land. My.
They battle relentlessly.
Because this place is always flooding.
And over time, eons of this, they simply do not know how to stop killing each other.
So you've got this breeding ground for incredibly nasty ants there in northern Argentina. All these different groups.
All fighting and more or less keeping each other in line.
But one day... In the 1800s, a steamship rolls up to, say, Buenos Aires, which is a big port at the mouth of these two rivers.
A boat pulls up, a ramp comes down, and...
Somehow, a couple of ants from one of those Argentine ant families...
...are up the gangplank, probably, you know, within the first hour.
You know, because they're always fleeing floods, so they're programmed to move. That's what they do.
They're moving into coffee bags. You can imagine they're moving into all kinds of things.
And then the boat pulls out... And this family of ants leaves their war-torn hellhole of a homeland behind. Until eventually...
Sooner or later, it was bound to happen. 1891 is the first time they were seen there.
They show up in New Orleans.
And then, 1907, they leapfrogged all the way to California.
California! Here I come.
They were simultaneously found in San Francisco and Los Angeles, I believe.
How did they get to California?
Well, the Panama Canal wasn't open yet, so it seems likely they took the train.
Wow. Now, here's the thing about these ants that make them different from all the other ants. Because they grew up in this crazy, blood-soaked floodplain of death,
their survival strategy was pretty simple. Kill everything. If it's not one of us... kill it, no matter what.
Other ants will have occasional sex with other ant groups, capture them and make them into slaves, adopt their children. These ants?
These ants don't fool around.
They don't have sex outside the group, they never take slaves, and if they catch your babies...
they eat them.
And it turns out there's a side benefit to being a cruel, segregationist, violent bastard. Because being that way allows these ants to stay pure.
Genes stay the same, they're genetically pure.
Yeah, genetically pure. When they stay genetically pure, they can stay unified as a group. And when they do that, they can spread in ways the other ants just can't. Because see, ants use smell. Like, that's how they know who's in and who's out. First thing they do when they meet another ant is they sniff them using their antenna.
Something sort of like a tap, 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 tap. Sniff, 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 sniff.
They register odor. As long as they sense that identity throughout the individuals they meet, they are happy.
Now, with most ants, as they spread over vast distances, they start to commingle with other ants, queens come and go, and inevitably that smell nationality dilutes, it begins to change.
But with these Argentine ants, the smell doesn't change from queen to queen or from nest to nest. Even if they go way off, conquer totally new territory, build distant nests.
All these different nests function as sort of a fluid network. They can fuse and fission through time. For example, you might be nesting on the edge of a sidewalk and the sprinklers come on. Everybody evacuates and all the queens and workers and babies get moved to higher ground and may fuse with a nest that's already existing at the higher ground.
So all these Argentine ants living across the South in the U.S., they get along.
And if you don't have to worry about each other, and you've killed off everything else,
they can focus their energy on producing more Argentine ants.
And all you have to do is outnumber the enemy enough, and you can wipe out anything.
Even an animal 5,000 times their size.
Horned lizards are dropping in abundance out in California because the ants simply run all over them and they can never sleep. These lizards normally eat ants, but they simply can't grab these ants. They're too fast and too small. And so they're literally being killed by their own food.
Hmm.
To sum up, they're very nasty, very loyal, and they're extraordinarily numerous. Put those three things together, and what you get is Genghis Khan in an ant.
See the USA in your Chevrolet.
During the 1950s, this tight-knit, brutal family of ants starts to spread deeper into California.
Thanks in large part to all the new freeways. Because now they could spread faster and farther, like, say you
put out a potted plant on your front porch.
The ants move in.
Overnight.
Next day.
Pick up that plant and move it, you know, 100 miles away the next day.
There they are, in this new place that's so far away from where they were yesterday, and they can conquer that.
And not only that. It is, after all, the 1950s and 1960s, and you got suburbs springing up all over America.
Lots of lawns, lots of sprinklers. Mm. They go on, off, on, off, on, off. Which, if you're an ant, is...
in many ways very similar to...
home.
Fresh terrain that's been exposed by the receding floodwaters. Humans have modified the habitat in California in ways that Argentine ants really like.
So, the Argentine ants are happy.
And most people don't even notice this is happening.
Until we get to the 1990s. In fact, in 1998, Neil, our entomologist friend, and his colleague Andy Suarez, they're now studying Argentine ants around San Diego, and they begin to wonder, how far can a family like this of ants spread and still remain pure and still remain loyal to each other? So in the summer of that year, Neil and Andy hop into a car and they go on a little road trip. Starting in San Diego and heading north. They took a cup full of Argentine ants from San Diego and periodically they would stop, get out of the car, kneel down with their ant hookah pipes and suck up local ants, whoever happened to be there, and then plop those ants into the cup with the San Diego ant. Now, if the ants think they're part of the same colony, they won't fight.
That's right. So we put in ants from Los Angeles, tap, 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 sniff, 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 and they recognize San Diego ants as being members of the same colony.
So they know the colony extends at least from San Diego to Los Angeles, but they keep going.
We go up to Santa Barbara, tap, 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 tap. No aggression, sniff, 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 sniff. Nothing.
No fighting.
To San Luis Obispo, tap, 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 tap. Same thing, sniff, 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 sniff. They think they're all members of the same colony.
Still no fighting.
Up to San Francisco, tap, 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 tap. Same thing, sniff, 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 sniff. And this continues.
All the way to a little town 100 miles north of San Francisco.
And that site displayed no aggression towards the ants that we collected at the very beginning of our road trip from over 600 miles away in San Diego.
Just think about that for a second, okay? Remember those anthills you might have had in your front lawn, you know, little mounds? Imagine one of those 600 miles wide, give or take, with trillions and trillions of ants in it.
Scientists call this a super colony.
The large California super colony.
And as scientists kept tracking this colony, they realized
these ants had hitchhiked far beyond California.
They're all over Europe. Europe's got the largest colony known.
That's Australian ant scientist Melissa Thomas.
Yes.
In 2002, she worked with David Holway to chart just how far this one super colony has expanded.
Australia has some.
Up and down Spain, all around Italy, around Greece.
Japan, many Atlantic and Pacific islands, Hawaii, Easter Island, places like that.
They've taken over much of northern New Zealand. They've taken over parts of South Africa.
All these places are occupied by the same family of... Are they the same colony?
They think they're all members of the same colony.
In fact...
We imported Argentine ants from Japan, Hawaii, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, brought them to UC Berkeley.
And they put all of these ants from all these different places in the same cup.
Like we did on our road trip. Tap, 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 tap. Sniff, 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 sniff.
And no fighting. You've got, say, an ant from Okinawa in Japan and an ant from Genoa in Italy. They're 6,000 miles distant, maybe 150 generations apart.
And yet they still know each other. Because the smell that bonds them together hasn't changed.
At some point in the past, you know, one colony in Argentina got picked up and moved around and spread and continued to spread and continued to spread. The descendants of those ants we have now across all continents except Antarctica, they still think they're all members of the same family.
So here you've got this monoculture, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really violent on the edges.
On the edges, yeah.
But then if you're on the inside and part of the group, very, very peaceful.
And since there's only one other creature that can do this, that can create an allegiance across vast, vast spreads of Earth, I couldn't help but ask Neil, do you ever analogize to human history when you look at these things?
It's tempting to, but I try not to because these sorts of situations are kind of a Rorschach. You can see whatever you want to in them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for our Argentine ant research, we've had people say, look, the lesson from this is that we should all be like Argentine ants and get along and cooperate and we'll succeed. But then, on the other hand, I've had, you know, white supremacist websites cite my research and say, you know, this is evidence that the key to success is not mixing the races.
Mm. The unsettling part is that, at least in efficacy, like, they're right. This has been a very successful formula for these ants.
Well, if it lasts.
Right. Which brings us to...
Jill.
What's your whole big name?
Jill Shanahan.
Jill Shanahan. In 1995, Jill was working with Andy Suarez in San Diego, helping him map the ant empire. And one day, as part of her job, she found herself in...
a park in a housing complex.
Just outside San Diego, looking for Argentine ants.
Mm-hmm.
So do you find some?
Yeah, I believe that there is a colony at the base of a tree.
Now, before she left, she grabbed some Argentine ants from the lab. And these tree ants, they looked exactly the same as her lab ants.
They're pretty easy to identify.
And she figured they would just meet the new ants and go sniff, 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 get along.
Or ignore each other.
But when she plopped one of these tree ants into the cup with one of her lab ants...
these guys were fighting. One was more aggressive than the other and started biting the other one. And then they grapple each other and get into a tight little ball and just...
And you're watching this,
mm.
and no one has ever seen Argentine ants fight before.
Mm.
You're seeing something nobody's seen before. Did you have any sense that that was happening?
No, I guess not.
This is a big deal.
Because what it means is that another family of Argentine ants had made it over from the old country and brought that old fight to America.
If I was going to spend a lot of time at the...
So scientists like Melissa began to wonder, how big is this new empire? And where do the two meet?
Exactly. Our goal was to find where that territory met in nature.
So Melissa heads out with her standard ant gear, the hookah pipe thing to suck up the ants, the fight cup to plop them into.
Right.
She'd do the fight cup test in all these different places in the area, trying to zero in on where that border might be.
I'd slowly sort of get closer and closer and closer.
And eventually, she finds herself walking down a street in a normal subdivision in Escondido. She looks down, and she sees it. This thick channel of death.
Dead bodies. Hundreds. Hundreds of thousands. Hundreds of thousands of dead bodies.
And from all directions, live ants were
pouring into this area and fighting to the death. Masses and masses of them fighting.
Piles and piles of them, killing each other.
It's pretty extraordinary to see, actually.
There were times when we didn't even need to get out of the car to find the super colony boundary because you'd see the dead workers spilling over the curb.
Spilling.
No. Spilling.
Which brings us back to where we started, with that driveway and David Holloway.
Oh my God.
They're just like almost bouncing off the bottom.
This then is the price of empire. These ants have conquered a huge portion of the globe.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
But every day, they pay the price in bodies at the border.
Like, this guy has lost all of, you see, he's only got limbs on one side now.
And that price might be going up, because scientists have now figured out that several more families of Argentine ants have hitchhiked their way over.
Yeah, this is what I expected.
Are they going to die?
Like.
The ones that are really injured probably won't live too much longer.
Oh my God, those two.
So in the end, this strategy of violence and intolerance seems to be pretty good, until it meets itself.
Or even worse, something badder than itself.
Oh my God, those two. When you shook the...
Oh, look, they got free. Oh, but that other one. Look, he's just throwing into another fight.
Oh, look, Robert, look.
They're going into a circle.
Oh, they're in the...
The ball of death. Well, not quite.
No,
they've
not
just
quite.
Separated.
They sort of locked. We will
become the ball. Big thanks to Douglas Smith for production help on this piece.
Douglas.
And now we're going to switch. We're going to switch empires, switch species, and we're going to look at a war that you can see if you're up in space looking down, and we're going to tell you why it's a good war, a great war, and a war we need. We sat down with Ari Daniel Shapiro.
Okay.
And he told us this story.
Here it comes.
All right, yeah. So here we are at the Center for the Culture of Marine Phytoplankton.
This is Willie.
And I always say...
Willie Wilson. Willie Wilson is his name? Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, my dad's William Wilson. There's a long line of William Wilsons.
Your son?
My son is Angus, but he's Angus William Wilson. So,
love that guy. Willie works at the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences in Maine.
Okay.
And he studies these tiny plant-like creatures that live in the sea called phytoplankton. He keeps them in a fridge in these little test tubes. Half full of kind of a greenish water.
Let's have a look at that.
He pulled one out and showed it to me. And it doesn't really look like there's that much going on in there.
But actually, right at the bottom, you can see what looks like a...
Like a white...
Sort of goo.
What is it?
It's the carnage of war.
Huh.
In that test tube that Willie's holding are millions of tiny single-celled plants called coccolithophores.
Coccolithophores.
Yeah, and there are lots of them in the sea.
There's probably about 100,000 of these coccolithophores in a teaspoon of seawater.
Tell me about the coccolith. Like, what do they look like?
They're basically like tiny little translucent balls with, you know, there's a slight tinge of green. But the key thing is
the outside of that ball, it has these white plates.
Tiny circular shields of chalk.
Because the coccolithophores are fighting for their lives.
Fighting with whom? Each other?
Viruses. These viruses that are shaped like diamonds. So here's what happens. Imagine you're a coccolithophore.
Okay.
Floating in the ocean, and along comes this diamond-shaped virus. And it jams its diamond tip into you.
Between these plates and actually get inside the cell.
The chinks way. In the armor.
That's right, it's like the chinks in the armor.
And the coccolithophore just engulfs it.
And the virus thinks, yes, I'm in here. And then it sort of makes straight to the nucleus.
And it's at that moment that the viral takeover begins. The virus kind of hijacks the cellular machinery that's usually used by the coccolithophore to make more coccolithophore stuff. And it starts making more viruses.
So inside the coccolithophore now, there are these little diamonds multiplying.
Yeah, they're filling up that space. And eventually, all these viruses head out of the coccolithophore.
In big belches, or?
Like a steady stream of viruses.
Wow.
And each one of these viruses has the ability to go on and infect another coccolithophore cell.
In fact, those coccolithophores in that test tube that Willie showed me...
If I shake this, stuck to the bottom a little bit, yeah.
Those were in the process of dying.
You smell that? Yeah, so that, what you're smelling there, that's the infection. That's dimethyl sulfide you're smelling. So the infection is already occurring in this culture.
And when the coccolithophore dies, those white shields
kind of fall off the cell.
They sort of gradually sort of rain off over the course of the infection.
So as it's dying, after it's spewed out these viruses, it just sheds its plate, mm-hmm. and it kind of... and then it dies.
Yeah.
And that creates this white chalkiness.
Yeah.
Well, so this means like the coccolithophores are not doing very well.
Well, they've got a couple of tricks up their little calcified sleeves. Sometimes when a virus enters, the coccolithophore will send out a chemical signal.
They're sort of shouting, hey, it's too late for me.
But save yourselves.
Oh.
And initially, this signal's pretty weak in the water. But as more and more coccolithophores are infected, the chorus of this chemical beacon grows louder and louder.
And so the other cells, they hear these messages.
And they change by messing with their DNA a bit. And they go from having those white shields on the outside to having these jaggedy scales.
Which we think might be impenetrable.
Scales instead of these plates.
That's right. Yeah, shields. Yeah, that's right.
Why aren't they just scaly all the time?
Because when they're scaly, they can't be the best coccolithophores they can be. They just don't grow as well.
So scaly is an adaptation against the viruses.
Exactly. And then finally, if all else fails...
programmed cell death.
The coccolithophores just commit suicide.
It just shuts down and kills itself to prevent propagation of viruses.
But over time, the viruses have figured out how to
prevent the cell from killing itself.
So it delays the death of the coccolithophore for as long as possible to maximize the number of viruses that can get out.
Wow, this is serious.
Yeah, it's like an arms race.
There's a constant battle to be fitter than you were several generations ago. And without...
Here's the crazy thing. This battle is happening all through the surface of the ocean. There are legions of coccolithophores dying all the time. And the coccolithophores are shedding their white shields.
It's like taking millions of tiny little mirrors and putting them in the surface of the ocean.
So many that you can actually see this carnage from space.
You can see this from space?
Yeah.
You get the massive blooms that cover almost the whole of the North Atlantic. I mean, you get this sort of milky bloom that covers anything from, you know, off the west coast of Scotland and the southern Iceland almost all the way to Newfoundland. In the southern hemisphere, you get this sort of massive milkiness that circumnavigates the globe.
These vast swirls of milky water curling around islands and continents.
And that's all carnage from this battle.
Billions and billions of soldiers that have fallen in the field.
Wow.
That we can view from space.
It probably is trillions if you're talking on that scale.
Yeah, I think,
what's after trillions?
Quadrillion?
You think it's wearing the quadrillions? Just say it, see how it feels.
There are quadrillions of soldiers dying.
How did that feel?
It felt good. If I were to be an astronaut, how often would I see these sorts of blooms?
All the time, somewhere on the planet.
Every day, every hour?
Every day, every hour. There's going to be a bloom going on somewhere. You know, a good example is off the Norwegian fjords. They start in the fjords and late April into May time, and then they sort of creep out of the fjords like this huge living amoeba. Fishermen hate it because the fish can't see the lures, so they can't catch the fish anymore.
And as the shields rain off and fall down to the ocean floor, they build up and build up over time.
Millions of years of sedimentation of these sort of chalk particles.
That's actually what led to the creation of the Cliffs of Dover, the White Cliffs of Dover in England.
Shut up, really?
Yes.
This is sort of geology in action.
And not just that, when the coccolithophores get decimated by the virus, it kind of clears out the ocean for other phytoplankton to bloom. And then they get mowed down by their viruses. And then the coccolithophores might bloom again. And then they get wiped out. And this cycle...
I mean, all these battles, I mean, it's all responsible for about half the oxygen that we breathe.
Really? Half the oxygen we breathe?
Half the oxygen.
Whoa.
Because when the phytoplankton bloom, they take in carbon dioxide and they release a puff of oxygen. And then they're cut down by these viruses, but they grow back up again, and another breath is released. So the whole system is just kind of breathing.
People think of the lungs of the planet are the rainforests, and that's kind of half the picture, but every other breath we take comes from the phytoplankton in the ocean that are going through these battles on a daily basis.
So this is a battle that rages every single day somewhere in our oceans.
Yeah, we need the battle to live.
Ari, thank you.
Sure.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.